And then they drifted beyond me, looking for the others. He wouldn't find them. It was just me on those walls, among the lines of soldiers in green uniforms that clashed with the sky and stones around them. Sam's mouth pulled up wanly at the corners when he realized I'd come alone.
I guess it is a pretty uncivilized hour for an execution, he said as he was jostled past me. Can't expect everyone to be out of bed.
He was out of earshot before I could say anything back. The soldiers took him to the edge of the wall, standing him a dozen paces away from the firing squad. An albish man with long pale robes leaned a hand on Sam's shoulder, speaking in a low voice to him.
He's asking if he has any last words he would like passed on to his family.
Captain Westcroft was standing next to me, hands clasped behind his back. He looked as tired as Sam after last night's invasion.
To give them comfort when they are told the news.
Sam considered for a moment, and then leaning his head forward, he answered him. The man's brow furrowed before his face slid back to complacency, nodding sagely as he touched our imposter bandit over his heart. He stepped back as another soldier came forward to place the blindfold over Sam's eyes. He knotted it at the back of his head just as the sun started to rise, turning the blue dawn light into a blazing ember. Captain, I spoke to the man at my elbow. I know you're not going to have a whole lot of reasons to trust me after today, but I'm going to give you some advice that I wish I'd had sooner. Don't underestimate the Sultan. If you ever think you're outsmarting him, chances are you're about to be proved wrong in a very deadly way. Captain Westcroft raised his reddish brows at me curiously, but I kept my eyes straight ahead. They were foreigners. It wasn't my job to protect them. But then Sam was a foreigner, too. And here I was. The robed man who had spoken to Sam crossed the short space back to us. He looked at me and then said something quick and albish to the captain.
Your young friend's final words,
the captain translated,
were that he would like it noted that he was right. Being heroic leads to death.
The smile that danced across my face didn't linger there. As the soldiers moved away and the dozen men with rifles stepped forward, Sam suddenly looked terribly alone and scared. I felt my breathing turn shallow as the sun crested the mountain. The captain shouted an order in Elvish. As one, the six soldiers in uniform clattered their gilded rifles to attention. Sam flinched at the noise. Silence came, and it seemed like all the soldiers watching held their breath at once. From overhead, I heard the whistle of a bird, three short bursts. There was a whole lot that could still go wrong, but at least we were ready. Another shouted order came. The guns pointed at him. I readied myself to move, legs tensing in anticipation.
Ready!
The shout came. I rocked onto the balls of my feet, leaning forward just a little.
Aim!
Sam tilted his head back to catch the first rays of the sun, like he wanted to see it all one last time, even though he was blindfolded. Like he wished he'd known that yesterday was the last dawn he'd get. Maybe if he had, he would have watched it, instead of spending the time in the dark under the tunnels of Isman, waiting to save my life. Maybe he wouldn't be here at all. In that second, his pale hair turned to pure gold in the sunlight.
Fire!
Six fingers squeezed triggers at the same moment that I moved, running forward, even as the racket of shots sounded, filling the air with the familiar scent of gunpowder. gunpowder without any bullets. I barreled through the smoke easily, past the men averting their eyes against the sound and noise and sight of death. I plunged toward where Sam was standing, waiting for a bullet that would never come. I slammed into him at full speed, pushing him toward the cliff edge. He staggered back to the edge of the ramparts, and then we pitched over into nothingness. And for just a second, we were in wide open air, falling, plunging toward the rocks below. Then we hit. Not jagged rocks, but cloth pulled taut, giving way beneath our bodies, bowing just enough to catch us. It was the sheets and blankets we'd smuggled out of Jin's room, strung out between Iz and Maz as they surged upward in the shape of two huge rocks, bursting through the smoke from the gunfire. I heard surprised cries from below, their huge wings buffeting the assembled crowd violently as they flew higher over the mountains until we were out of range of both guns and any kind of air magic the Albish army could turn on us. I was still trying to catch my breath as Sam struggled next to me, panicked and still blind. "Stop squirming!" I shouted close to his ear, over the sound of rushing air as we flew.
"Am I dead?"
Sam asked too loudly in his own language, still twisting. I yanked the blindfold off, and he blinked his startled blue eyes at me, taking in my face, the wings above my head that were carrying us to safety, and the endless open sky above that. His head jerked from side to side, seeing Jin on Maz's back to our right, Tamid on Iz's to our left. "You're not dead!" I shouted over the wind, as the enormous sling swung precariously in the wind. "Now stop moving before you kill us both!" He did as he was told, lying perfectly immobile, as we rushed over the mountains, up, across, and down, until we were back over the desert. I could feel the sand nearby, even before I felt solid ground as the twins landed, setting the sling down gently. Jin slid off Maz's back, pulling me to my feet, while Tamid stayed stubbornly seated on Iz. Jin checked me over quickly, looking for any new wounds. He wouldn't find any. I didn't grow up in the shadow of a weapons factory without learning a thing or two, like how to turn a bullet into a blank. Sam let us haul him to his feet, but as soon as we let him go, he collapsed back to sitting on the ground.
"On second thought, I'm not going to do that."
His words were calm, but his voice was shaking.
"Standing seems a little ambitious right now."
Jin dropped into a crouch across from Sam.
"You all right there?"
he asked him, as he set to work on Sam's shackled hands. There was a note of tension in his voice, but Sam wasn't going to notice it. He didn't need to know what had passed between me and Jin last night about saving his life.
"Well..."
Sam seemed to take stock of himself.
"My legs don't exactly seem to be working, and I've pledged my allegiance to so many different gods that I am not going to be able to be faithful to them all."
He was babbling at a frantic pace.
"I'm guessing being caught being unfaithful to a god is probably twice as unfortunate as being caught being unfaithful to a woman, and I'm still not sure I'm not hallucinating all this."
He squinted up at me.
"But other than that, I've had worse days." "It's only dawn,"
Jin said, as the shackles came free with a satisfying click, falling into the sand.
"It could still get worse."
He clapped Sam on the back amicably as he got to his feet.
"So, just to be clear..."
Sam rubbed at his newly freed hands.
"Why exactly am I not dead?"
"Because you're one of us." I reached down a hand to help Sam to his feet. He looked steadier now.
Which means you're ours to execute for treason, not theirs.
Sam squinted up at me for a moment, and then a grin split his face. A real one.
Shut up, I warned him. I could already see the beginnings of something smart on his tongue.
I always knew you had a soft spot for me.
He clasped my fingers, letting me pull him up.
Only for your knack for getting us out of a tight spot.
I let go of his hand.
Come on, we need to keep moving.
Sam was still getting his bearings after nearly dying, but his gaze flicked quickly around from me to Jin to Tamid, who was still refusing to look at anyone from where he sat.
Where's the princess?
He asked.
Ah, Layla. Jin's traitor sister was the one thing he and I were able to agree on. She was a burden to our rescue mission at best, a liability at worst. So we'd left her, and I'd scrawled out a note for Bilal that I'd handed to one of his soldiers to give to him. Take care of her. She might be your last line of defense if the Sultan comes knocking. Layla might be trouble for us, but she would make a decent shield for Ilyaz as a hostage. She might keep the mountain from being burned off the map before we got back.
She was extra weight, was all I said in answer to Sam.
And if there's one advantage to traveling without a whole army, Jin said, tossing his compass from one hand to another, the needle still pointing due south. It's being able to move quickly.
Chapter 16.
Flying got boring after a while. After the initial rush of leaping into the air, the desert shrinking below, the wind whistling an excited tune in our ears as we soared higher above the ground than wingless creatures were ever meant to. After all that wore off, it was just a whole lot of waiting. Hot sun tracking our every mile, arms cramping from clinging to Maz's back, the wind drowning out any chance to talk as we headed south, following Jin's compass. We flew farther west than the compass told us to, so that we could fly close to the mountains that ran along Miraji's border. It was better than heading due south across the desert, risking running out of water before we found Aramot. We were headed south without an army, or a plan, or any idea what we were facing. But the way I saw it, there wasn't a whole lot else to do now except follow Jin's compass and see what we found at the end. Every day we wasted was another day our friends were imprisoned. Maybe in danger. Maybe dying. It was the end of our first day of traveling when I noticed the landscape was starting to look familiar. A break in the thankless stretch of desert, a break in the endless view of golden sand and blue skies, a jagged break in the ground, the Dev's Valley. My heart skipped as I craned over Maz's back, peering down below us. We were skimming over the northernmost edge of it. It was the same path that we would take home if we were coming back from the north. Returning from a mission for Ahmed, with Shahzad next to me. Because somewhere far below us, hidden in the twists and turns of those canyons, was what used to be our home. The wreckage of the rebel camp. The desperate, reckless urge hit me to ask Maz to take us down. Maybe if he could just land in the valley, we could go home again. I could shoo away all the sand that I'd buried the camp in when we had to escape and unearth it like some ancient relic. We could all be safe again for a little while. But that was foolish. We were too far from that home now. Instead, we stopped near the city of Fahali just as the sun was beginning to set. As close as we dared land near civilization. A side effect of escaping by the skin of our teeth was that more than just Layla had been left behind in Ilyaz. Food, weapons, water skins. A whole lot of things that we were bound to need on the way south.
Sam and I will go,
Jin said, counting out the small stash of money we had.
It's not safe for Demji these days.
Because you both think that being from halfway around the world is less conspicuous? I stretched my legs, sore from a day of gripping onto Maz's feathered back.
I mean,
Sam scratched the top of his head.
I'd say I'm definitely less conspicuous than blue skin and blue hair.
Hey, Iz said, even as Maz, in the shape of a large lizard, managed to look offended. I ought to go, I argued, glancing at the city on the horizon. So long as I don't look anyone in the eye, it ought to be fine.
Right,
Jin said, flipping a 2-luzi coin along his knuckles.
When's the last time you got in any trouble when left to your own devices?
But he flipped the coin in my direction all the same. I caught it out of the air as he handed the rest of our money over. He knew I was right. Foreigners in this part of the desert during a war would arouse suspicion. I paused as I rewrapped my shima. Tamid was unstrapping his false leg, sitting on the ground. None of us knows where the compass is leading. I could tell he knew I was talking to him, even though he wasn't looking at me. This might be the closest thing to civilization we see for a while. You could stay here if you wanted. When this is all over, there'll be trains running again, back down to Dustwalk.
No.
He didn't look up.
The compass points south, and south is the way to Dustwalk. I'll keep going with you as far as I need to get home.
Home. If home was Dustwalk instead of the Dev's Valley, that was the last home I wanted to go back to. Fahali wasn't just any city. It was the first city that had knelt to Ahmed after we'd saved it from being annihilated by Noorsham. It was one of our cities. Or it used to be. It had been occupied by the Galen for nearly 2 decades before that. Now, with the news that Ahmed was dead, it was an uncertain city. As I walked through the streets, I could feel the unease. News of impending war and invasion must have reached them. Everyone kept their eyes down, moving quickly, as if they were afraid to be outside too long. I kept my own eyes to the ground as I navigated the city, my shima pulled over my face. There were people here who would know me, even if I didn't stand out like Jin or the twins would. This city knew me, and once I'd known it pretty damn well, too. But it had changed since we were last here. The streets were filled with women in rags, begging, and children running around barefoot. Where the sprawling market ought to have been, the streets were empty, shops boarded up. I felt a tug on my clothes. I snapped around quickly, grabbing the small hand that had been trying to find its way into my pockets. It was a little girl, her eyes big in her gaunt face. I wasn't doing anything! The boldness of the lie was somewhat undercut by the panic in her expression. It's all right. I dropped to my knees, though I didn't let her go in case she fled. You think you could tell me what's happening here? The waif looked at me warily, as if she didn't believe that I didn't know. Food doesn't come anymore, she said finally. My papa says it's our punishment for turning against the Sultan. So the Sultan was starving them out for allying with us. He could do that. Most of the desert's trade came on the caravans or on trains from eastern Miraji. If he'd cut off what was coming from across the mountains, then there wouldn't be enough for everyone. Well, you can tell your papa. There's a difference between punishment and revenge. I let her go, pushing my Shima away as I leaned back against the wall, silently cursing the Sultan's name. Ahmed would never have let this happen if he were still here. Hell, he would never have let this happen if he were Sultan. I'd seen Ahmed give up his own food to people hungrier than him more than once. I was going to have to leave this starving city without supplies. Iz or Maz could probably catch us a rabbit to cook up in the hills for tonight. And then after that, we'd have to survive. We were good at that. It was why we were still here. I let her go, but the little girl didn't dash away like I'd expected. She was staring at me curiously. Now we were directly eye level. "Are you the blue-eyed bandit?" she asked boldly. And then before I could answer, she kept going. "Are you here to save us? The man in the uniform said you would save us." "What man in the uniform?" "The one who came through the city a few days ago. He said the rebellion would save us. He said he was a general, and he knew. He said his daughter was with them, and that all of you would save us." General Hamad, Shahzad's father. He had come through this way. My head dashed around without thinking, like I might be able to spy him among these streets, like he wasn't long gone. "Was he right?" she asked insistently. "Are you here to save us?" I wanted to lie, to tell her that I would, that I could save them. But I was just a girl from Dustwalk. "No," I straightened. "I'm not here to save you. But I'm going to try to save someone else for you." They needed more than a girl from Dustwalk. They needed their prince. They needed his general. The best I could do was try to bring the real saviors back. It was our sixth day of flying when the direction of Jin's compass changed abruptly in his hands. It had been pointing due south since we left Ilyaz, heading over the desert as straight as a bullet. But now, suddenly, it swung back north. We'd passed over our target. Jin quickly leaned over Maz's neck, giving him instructions. Maz did as he was told, plunging us toward the sand. Iz followed behind. I squinted through the haze of the afternoon heat as we descended. There, not far off, was a town, the first we'd seen in days. I hadn't even noticed it when we'd passed over it a moment ago, but I knew it instantly all the same. Juniper City. It was where I'd gotten on a train to Isman a year ago, and where Jin had caught up with me as I tried to head north with his compass. They called it a city, and back then it was the biggest place I'd ever seen. But since then, I'd seen Isman. Juniper City didn't look like much in comparison. Jin's compass was pointing straight toward it. Something wasn't right here. I knew I ought to be happy. I ought to feel some hope that we were close, that we'd found our people. But this wasn't exactly Aramot, the prison of legends. It was just a big town in the desert. And I might not trust Layla, but I knew she hadn't lied to me. Instead of hope, a new fear was being born in my chest. That this was a wild goose chase. That we were going the wrong way. That Ahmed and the others weren't going to be here. But there was only one way to know for sure. We walked in silence, following Jin's compass to the city. Iz became a small bird flying excitedly ahead of us, then back again, while Maz sat on my shoulder, a little blue-headed lizard basking in the afternoon sun. It was slow going with Tamid's bad leg, and I caught him glancing back over his shoulder more than once as we walked. Back in the direction of Dustwalk. I'd promised to get him as close to home as possible. This was pretty damn close. By tomorrow morning, he would be home, and I could tell myself all I liked that it wasn't my home anymore, but the only thing that had made it bearable that last year I'd lived there, after my mother was hanged, was Tamid. And even if he hated me, I didn't know that I had it in me to hate him. I only hated that he was going back. That I was losing one more person. Not to death, maybe, but to somewhere I'd never see him again, just the same. It was nearer to dusk than noon when we passed through the city gates. Jin and Sam wore their shimas tight to hide their foreignness as best they could as we joined the crowds in the streets. The war had not reached this far south yet in earnest, but there were still signs of it. Supplies from anywhere other than the desert or the nearby mountains seemed fewer in the market stalls, and there were more men carrying weapons on the street than I remembered. We followed Jin's compass past colorful stalls in the souk, through streets that were clean and wide compared to Isman's old maze. This was a new city. Its name was in Marajin instead of the old language. We ducked under canopies and around brightly painted buildings, past women dragging whining children away from stalls of sweets. And then finally we rounded the corner of a bright blue house, and I saw a small boy crouched in a doorway, something glittering in his hands. We all hung back uncertainly, watching the little boy. He couldn't have been more than 6, and he was talking to himself under his breath as he turned the compass over and over, in that way children do when they are playing make-believe, spinning a story in their minds. Weaving a world where they're more than just a grubby boy on the street playing with a toy compass, or a skinny girl out the back of a house with a gun and tin cans, pretending they're a great explorer on an adventure, or a blue-eyed bandit. One of us needed to talk to him. Jin moved first, and the rest of us watched from the mouth of an alley as he crouched down, resting his arms on his knees. The little boy looked up, staring at Jin with big, dark eyes, wary but not afraid.
"Hello."
Jin greeted him, pulling down his shima to show his full face.
"What's your name?"
"I'm Oman." Of course he was. Half the little boys in this country were named Oman, after the Sultan.
"Oh, really?"
Jin said, leaning forward on his knees.
"Oman is my father's name."
I'd never heard Jin call the Sultan his father in all the months I'd known him.
"Do you think you could tell me where you got that compass, Oman?"
"I found it," Oman said, gripping the compass a little tighter to his chest. "I didn't steal it."
"I believe you,"
Jin said patiently. I could see that he was worried, the way his thumb ran circles along the opposite hand as he clasped them together in front of him. Because if Ahmed didn't have the compass, we didn't have a way to find Ahmed.
"Where did you find it?"
"Train station," the boy said finally.
"I didn't think there were any trains running these days,"
Jin said, looking my way. I shrugged unhelpfully. The trains from Isman had stopped months ago, best I knew, after we claimed the western desert. "They're not leaving," the boy said, with an eye roll like we might be stupid. "But sometimes they come in. They bring people with them."
"People like soldiers and prisoners?"
Jin asked. The little boy shrugged.
"And where do the people go?"
The boy shrugged again. "Out of the city. Toward the mountains." The Sultan was shipping prisoners. Juniper City was the farthest south you could get with a train. And then they were being taken on to Aramot, wherever that was. If it was even as real as Layla said. We were close, and we could find them, but every moment we wasted looking was another moment they were stuck there.
Oman,
Jin said seriously, looking at the little boy.
See, that compass belongs to my brother.
He reached into his pocket, pulling out the identical, albeit more battered, one.
It belongs to me now,
Oman said stubbornly.
I'll tell you what, Jin said. I'll buy it off you.
The 10 luzi that Jin produced from his pocket was a small fortune to a little boy. Oman grabbed it eagerly, dropping the compass in the dust. Jin returned to us, holding both compasses. His knuckles were white from clutching them so tightly. I reached out a hand, resting it over his. I couldn't tell him everything was going to be all right, because I couldn't lie. He shifted his hand in mine, and I thought he might be pulling away. But instead, he slipped Ahmed's compass into my grip.
We need a new plan, he said.
Chapter 17 The Beautiful General. Once in a desert, always at war, there was a great general who wished for an heir. Finally, after many years of prayer, his beloved wife grew great with child. But when she gave birth, it was not to a son, but to a daughter. The general put aside his disappointment, for he loved his daughter dearly, and she was a strong, healthy girl. And some years later, the general's wife bore another child, this time a boy. The general and his wife rejoiced, but quickly they saw that the child was not as strong as his sister. He was often sick, and he cried frequently, sometimes too quietly to be heard. Years passed, and the daughter grew strong and beautiful, while the son struggled. Some days, when the general's son was strong enough to go outside, his sister would sit and read to him. On one such day, another boy saw the general's frail son and began to mock him and throw stones at him, trying to goad him into fighting back. The general's daughter stood up to fight back instead. When the general broke up the fight, he found to his great surprise that his daughter had blood only on her fists, while the boy who had been throwing stones had blood on his face. In that moment, the general saw his daughter for who she was. She was the heir he had prayed for after all, the heir who would defend his family and his country when he was too old and frail. And so in secret, he taught his daughter to wield any weapon she chose, and he taught her how to win a battle, how to win a war if she had to. But still, he did not know what future awaited her. Then, one hot day, as she walked through the market in Isman, the general's daughter met the rebel prince, and she finally found the war that she was meant to fight. And in turn, she too became a general to a great ruler. The beautiful general stood up over and over again for those who couldn't stand for themselves, and others stood with her. And she won every fight, one after the other, the way her father had taught her to. Until the day she lost. The general's daughter was punished for daring to ask for a better world. She was sent deep into the darkness, hidden away, where a good death would never find her. Where she could not fight, for her jailers were not men of flesh and blood, but creatures of metal and magic. And for once she could find no escape, not even with her quick and clever mind. For the first time, the general's daughter was forced to watch instead of standing to fight. She watched over and over again as men and women burned in front of her eyes. And then the unholy creatures of metal turned their eyes on the young princess, the Demji sister of the rebel prince with the strange purple hair. The beautiful general's back ached from bowing it when she didn't want to. Her eyes hurt from turning away when men and women burned. Her throat pained from being silent. So the general loosened her tongue, opened her eyes, and straightened her back, and she stood up to walk into death in the young princess's stead. Chapter 18. I could feel time slipping away with every moment we weren't up in the mountains hunting for Aramot. Juniper City was struggling to govern itself without the rebellion or the Sultan. Neighborhoods were carving themselves up. Men with guns were charging innocent folks for protection from men with knives. The Sultan's army that came through didn't care. They were just there to transport prisoners. Neither did the other soldiers who came through, Foran and Mirajin, heading into the mountains never to come back, according to the whispers on the streets. Jin broke a man's hand when he tried to rob us at the inn we stayed at overnight. That put an end to any sign of trouble for us, though we still took turns keeping watch through the night. As if we were back in the desert and not safely behind walls. In the morning, we were woken by a group of men preaching loudly in the streets that it was the end of times, that death was coming for us from the mountains, that any who ventured out beyond the city and did not go with pure hearts would find death. I didn't know if our hearts were pure, but we were going to have to head out of the city one way or another. We had to find what was left of the rebellion, and we had to find it quickly. Every passing day was another day Ahmed or Delilah or Shahzad or Rahim might be dead. Except we had a stop to make first. I'd made a promise, after all. It was less than a day to dust walk from Juniper City, as the shapeshifter traveled. Less than a day between the place Tamid and I were born, and the city that had seemed impossibly far away my whole life. I wasn't sorry to get out of Juniper City, to finally be on the move, but I reckoned I could live another 100 years and never see dust walk again, and be happier for it. Only we'd promised to take Tamid back home if we could, and Demji kept their promises. Besides, I could feel Ahmed's compass heavy in my pocket, reminding me we didn't have any clear direction anyway. I knew when we were getting close to Dust Walk. The landscape didn't change. It was all barren desert flatland outside of Juniper City. But it was something I couldn't quite explain. A shift in the air, like it was wrapping itself around me, pulling me back. The accusatory glare of the sun on my neck, like I'd done something wrong by leaving. And then suddenly, there it was in the distance, etched against the perfectly blue desert sky, like a shadow against the day. The god-forsaken place that had raised me. I leaned down on Maz's feathered neck and shouted over the wind for him to take us down. I didn't need to get any nearer. "You ought to be able to walk from here," I said to Tamid as he slid from Iz's back. "Less chance of getting shot if you don't arrive from the sky on the back of a giant bird." Tamid stared up at me from the ground, where he was trying to steady himself on his bad leg.
"You're not coming with me?"
"You're the one who wants to go back, not me." Tamid dropped his head, nodded.
"So I guess this is goodbye, then."
"I guess so." I didn't move to get off Maz's back. We still had plenty of ground to cover, and we needed to use all the daylight we had. Tamid looked like he was about to say something else, but Jin spoke first.
"Something's wrong."
I twisted around on Maz's back to where Jin was sitting behind me. His eyes were fixed straight ahead on Dust Walk. I squinted against the bright desert light at the town. It looked exactly like I'd left it. Even from this far away, I could spy the wooden roof of the prayer house sticking up a little bit higher than the others around it. A few doors down would be my uncle's house. A few doors the other way was Tamid's, the only home in the whole town with two stories. I used to think Tamid's family was the richest I would ever know. Then I'd lived in a palace for a while. I realized what Jin meant. There were no signs of life. Even on a hot day, there ought to be a dash of movement. A face watching us through a window on the edge of town. Something. It looked deserted. I cursed under my breath as I slid off Maz's back. I could feel time running away from us. But while I might not want to set foot back in Dustwalk as long as I lived, I couldn't exactly leave Tamid alone here. He'd starve to death or get killed by a ghoul or a wild animal before he could get back to civilization. Looks like we're coming with you after all. It was slow going as we moved across the shifting sands, back toward the place that had made me. Part of me, at least. The dangerous, angry, restless, selfish part. The one I'd been trying to discard piece by piece. Tamid pulled ahead in spite of his bad leg, anxious to get home. I found myself falling farther and farther behind. Jin noticed. He slowed down, waiting for me until I fell into step beside him. You know the story of Ehof, the Wanderer? I asked. We were getting closer, no matter how slow I walked, and my breath was feeling shorter. Ehof was a farmer who left his home and defeated the ghoul that had been terrorizing his people. He was feasted in Isman for 100 days for what he had done. And then, at the end of it all,
he returned home and went back to tilling his fields and a peaceful life.
Jin filled in, tugging his shima a little so that it covered him from the glare of the sun.
My mother used to tell us that story.
So did mine. My eyes found the place where my mother's house used to be, before it burned. I wondered if on some night across the desert and sea, Jin and I were hearing the same story under the same stars from our mothers. I always hated that ending. How could you go home again after all that? After slaying monsters and saving princesses and dining in the homes of immortal beings? Jin kept his gaze straight ahead as he answered.
Back when this all started, I used to think there was nothing I wouldn't do to go home again.
It was rare for Jin to talk about Sicha. He hadn't told me much, that their small home overlooked the sea and always smelled of salt, that Jin and Ahmed shared a room, and Delilah shared another with Jin's mother, that the floor was always stained with dark dye from trying to hide Delilah's purple hair. They had a rotted roof that leaked so badly that when Jin was just 6 years old, he and Ahmed stole some wood from the docks and clambered onto the rafters to patch it up. There was a scar on his palm where he'd sliced it open with a rusty nail. I knew that place had been home for as long as he and Ahmed had been sailing, heading from dock to dock. It had been home until Ahmed had abandoned it for the desert, and Jin's mother had died, and Jin had collected Delilah to bring her to the country of their birth, to a place where they would have to make a home. I thought of Dev's Valley, the colorful tent I had shared with Shahzad for 30 years, of nights full of stars and warmth. I would give just about anything to go back to that home, too. Except it had been taken from us. And then it had been taken again when the Sultan ambushed us that night in Isman. This wasn't home. Neither of us had one of those anymore. The closer we got, the more obvious it was that Dustwalk was as quiet as a dead man. I waited for the twitch of curtains that would mean we were being watched on approach, or the sound of a voice. I felt an itch start on the back of my neck, a restlessness. There was danger here. Jin and I caught up to the others, drawing our guns at the same time on the outskirts of town. When I glanced back to my right, Sam had done the same, and the twins had shifted into large dogs with sharp teeth.
I lifted my finger away from the iron for a moment, moving it far enough from my skin that I was sure I could feel the sand at my fingertips, too, that my power hadn't abandoned me. And then we moved into the town as one.
The streets were empty as a drunk's glass. The door to the house that had belonged to Amjad al-Hiyamat was swinging in the wind, breaking the silence. Sand had built up in it, keeping it from shutting properly. I pushed it open with my foot, peering around the darkness inside. It was empty, but not wholly. A low table still sat in the middle, and in the room off to the side I could see a large bed. But everything else was gone. Clothes, food, cookware. Anything someone could carry. Like they'd fled. But not in a hurry. I emerged from the dark back into the desert sun, just as Jin stepped out of the prayer house across the way.
"No signs of struggle," he said. "Or looting."
"No bodies either," I said. "Folks just picked up and left, by the look of things." Tamid pushed by us, walking as quickly as his bad leg would allow. He didn't answer when I called out after him. I followed close behind as he rushed to his house, dread already sinking into my stomach. Walking into Tamid's house was like walking into a half-formed dream. It was exactly like I remembered it, but completely different. The blue of the dining room wall, the creak in the floorboard that always caused Tamid's mother to give me a nasty look whenever I came over, like I was the one making her house complain. These were familiar, but the house had been stripped, just like Amjad's. Only the things that were too big to carry were left.
"Mother!"
Tamid bellowed at the top of his lungs, standing at the foot of the stairs. His one good foot was on the bottom step. Stairs were hard for him with his bad leg. It was a lot of effort to make, just to be disappointed at the top. "They're not up there," I said what we already both knew. Tamid didn't look over his shoulder as he spoke to me. He kept his eyes fixed at the top of the stairs, like he could summon them.
"Where are they, then?"
"I don't know," I said.
"Are they dead?"
"Yes." I tried at first because it seemed likely. Blessedly, the word wouldn't come. "No," I said with a relieved sigh. "No, they're not dead." I headed back out into the street, leaving Tamid to have some time in the house where he was raised. It was unsettling, being outside in this quiet. I pulled my Shima away from my face as I wandered down the long row that made up Dustwalk's main street. The sun hit my head unforgivingly, like an angry parent's eye, wanting to know why I was getting home so late. I passed by the store. I wondered if Jin's blood was still on the floorboards where I'd sewn him up. "I fell in love with you when I was bleeding under a counter at the dead end of the desert, and you saved my life," Jin had said when he thought I was asleep back in Ilyaz. "Back when we were both who we used to be. We'd started here, he and I." My aunt's house was the last one on the row. It was exactly 250 paces from the shop. I knew because I'd counted it on hundreds of trips between the two. Something about it seemed different from the others. The door was closed, for one. I told myself I was imagining things. It only seemed different because I knew it so well. But still, I pushed inside carefully, heart pounding a frantic rhythm as the hinges creaked open for me, pouring sunlight into the dark of the house beyond. It was as empty as Tamid's. where this place had always been a riot of people, of wives and children. There was nothing here now. I wasn't sure whether I felt relieved or disappointed. I walked through the house, floorboards creaking below my feet as I went to the room I'd slept in once upon a time. Light flooded in here through the single window, one that was big enough for me to crawl in and out of in the dead of night. It was bare as a bone. But there, in the clear light of day, I realized why it seemed different. It was empty, but it didn't look abandoned. The floor was swept clean, unlike the other houses, which were clogged up with dust and sand. The window was washed, too. Someone had been keeping this place neat. They'd been here recently, by the look of things. Very recently. That was when I heard a shotgun being cocked behind me. Chapter 19. I'm raising my hands, I said automatically. As I did, my brain started scrambling for solutions to having a gun pointed at my back. I couldn't count on Jen or Sam to come looking for me quicker than a bullet could reach my spine.
Do it, a woman's voice said. And turn around so I can see you.
The figure behind me shifted, and I caught the glint of metal in the glass of the window. A reflection. It wasn't much, but enough that I could tell where she was. I shifted a little bit, taking stock of the sand clinging to my boots.
Turn around, I said.
The voice harped behind me, thick with last county accent.
If you can't move faster, I can put a jump in your step. I could move fast.
I grabbed for the desert at the same moment that I dropped to one knee in a violent twist of my body. I whipped my hand up, slamming the sand into the barrel of the gun, knocking it clean from her grasp. The shotgun clattered to the ground, skittering out of reach and into a corner. I was already back on my feet, releasing the sand, the sudden wrenching pain fading as I did, pistol out of its holster. Pointed straight at my Aunt Farah's chest. Farah froze where she was, staring at me. The shock as evident on her face as it must have been on mine, both of us looking for words. She found her tongue before I did.
I'd have thought you'd at least have the decency to be dead by now.
Well, that was a bold opener, considering I had a gun aimed at her. But then again, this was Dust Walk. We'd all had a gun aimed at us at one point or another. You got used to it.
So, I guess you've come crawling back after it didn't work out with whoever that man was that you rode off with. Wish I could say I'm surprised. How long did it take him to realize he couldn't beat the disrespect out of you? I tried for a year, and it didn't make a lick of difference.
It seemed like a lifetime ago that I'd last had to bear my aunt's insults and beatings. I'd spent the last year forgetting about Dust Walk and the girl I used to be here. But suddenly, standing across from her, it felt like it was just yesterday. I waited for her words to open fresh wounds, to make me feel small and angry and powerless against her, no matter that I was holding a gun. But none of that came. Her words felt hollow, like she was shouting at me from the bottom of a deep pit, and I was the only one of us who could see she was trapped in it.
Aunt Farah.
I lowered the gun, reholstering it. I could take her without a weapon if I needed to. What happened here? The house felt huge and empty around me. Where is everyone?
Gone.
Aunt Farah spat the word like it might be my fault.
Everybody had to pick up and leave.
What was there to stay for after the factory was destroyed? I remembered something Shira had told me back in the harem about how hard things had gotten in Dust Walk without the factory.
So maybe it was my fault,
Or djinns, if we were being really specific.
So what are you still doing here?
I asked.
Well?
A sly smile spread over her face as she smoothed a hand over her khalat.
Not that it's any of your business, but I'm waiting for a letter from my daughter.
Her tone was smug and self-satisfied, but her words just filled me with dread. She was talking about Shira, my cousin. Distantly, I remembered Shira telling me that I could trust Sam because she trusted Sam with her family, that he'd arranged to get letters and money down to Dustwalk for her. But there wouldn't be any more letters coming.
She's the Sultima now, you know,
Aunt Farah said. She hadn't heard.
Aunt Farah, I'm...
My voice caught, snagging on the words unhappily. I breathed out slowly.
Shira is...
I didn't want to be the one to bring this news, but it ought to be me, because I'd stood and watched as Shira was led to the execution block, as she went with every single bit of fight I'd expect from a desert girl. She died for the rebellion.
Aunt Farah, Shira was executed about 6 weeks back.
I waited for her face to crumble, but she just stared at me, expression frozen.
You're a liar.
I was a lot of things, but I wasn't that.
I was there. She died as bravely as anyone could. Her child, that is, your grandson,
I started, but Aunt Farah's face dissolved into a rage before I could finish.
Be quiet,
she snapped, her voice carrying loud enough that I reckoned the boys would hear it outside.
You're a lying little bitch, just like your mother was. And you'd better get back to whatever whorehouse you ran off to when that boy threw you out of his bed, you worthless!
I closed the space between us with one rapid step, and Aunt Farah staggered backward, her words cutting off. It was like she, too, was still expecting me to grow small under her blows. I suddenly realized that even though it might have been a year since I'd stood face to face with her, it hadn't been that long since I'd heard her voice. It was the same voice that had been whispering in my ear since Emin was executed, demanding to know who the hell I thought I was to be taking over this rebellion, chastising me for how high and mighty I seemed to believe myself, able to give orders in the place of a prince, even though I was just a nothing girl from nowhere, from poverty and misery and Dustwalk. Only I knew who I was. I had an answer to the stupid question that voice kept asking me. Who did I think I was? I was a genie's daughter. I was a rebel. I was an advisor to a prince. I had faced down soldiers and nightmares and skinwalkers. I had fought and survived. I had stood against a sultan time and time again. I had summoned an immortal being to his death. I had saved lives. And I had sacrificed lives, and I had seen more and done more good than she ever would. And I had done it in the name of saving people exactly like my aunt. The people of Dustwalk, who'd been turned bitter and angry and desperate by a country that didn't care about them. I had done it for a prince who did care what happened to them. I knew who I was. It was Dustwalk that had no idea who I'd become since I left.
I'm going to tell you once, I said calmly. My name is Amani, or the Blue-Eyed Bandit, if you're feeling formal.
I saw understanding register on her face. My legend had made it this far.
And not anything else.
I paused to make sure she understood that my name was not bitch or worthless or anything else. Before I stepped away from her.
Now, I have some questions, and I want straight answers.
You came here to wait for a letter from Shira. Where did you come here from? Where did everyone go? Her eyes.